on a very gut level and a heart level that we can all understand, there's a tremendous stigma and there's a tremendous hatred and hypocrisy towards people in the sex trade. On a more complicated level, it's tied in very much to the laws that exist. It's tied into the laws around poverty. It's tied into laws around colonialism. Sex work laws historically have been used more than anything to control women, mostly working class women, who escaped from sort of patriarchal norms of what a good woman was.
Feminists, abolitionists call for the decriminalization of the industry all the time. What are they saying? They're saying that all women are exploited. They're looking at women who are working, saying, you have not chosen to work. You are exploited. They're on a crusade to save women, but they're in that, they're totally implementing a patriarchal structure of how they're going to do it. And it's ridiculous and absolutely ironic, and they don't realize
that we can play a role in transforming the conditions, that we have a part to play, just like marriage was transformed, just like civic rights were transformed for women. Well, so sex work can be transformed as well, and that we can remain sex workers and denounce violence.
That violence, we can choose that we will not have it anymore, that we will eliminate it, because we will eliminate criminalization, we will eliminate the attitudes and the hatred. We will take this violence seriously.
So we are fighting right now to define sexual services as work.
Welcome to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy. This is episode 2 of a 4-week special presentation of CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project. My name is Brett Story, and today we will be further exploring the rights of sex workers and their struggle to better the conditions of their work by taking a look at decriminalization and labor organizing, two forms of legitimization that many sex workers view as necessary for the assertion of their rights as legal citizens and as workers. We will be talking today to Jen Clayman from the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers in Montreal and a representative of the International Union of Sex Workers in London, and Libby Davies, member of Federal Parliament from Vancouver East.
I'm entitled to work a job that is free from intimidations that are forced on me, from men who are out of line, out of step with time. And if you can't stand by me, don't stand in my way.
Ana Louise Crego, on behalf of the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers, spoke at a recent panel held on March 17th on the issue of police brutality against sex workers. She, like many sex workers and sex worker rights advocates, has much to say about the role Canadian criminalization laws play in enabling and perpetuating violence against sex workers. Here is a small portion of what she spoke about.
Gut level and a heart level that we can all understand, there's a tremendous stigma and there's a tremendous hatred and hypocrisy towards people in the sex trade. On a more complicated level, it's tied in very much to the laws that exist. It's tied into the laws around poverty. It's tied into, like it was mentioned at length before, laws around colonialism. Sex work laws historically have been used more than anything to control women, mostly working class women, who escaped from sort of patriarchal norms of what a good woman was. They were also used in colonial agendas. So, for example, in the Dominican Republic, right after the abolishment of sex slavery, the Spanish government put very harsh anti-prostitution laws as a way to imprison and force into labor all the black women they could. In the 1880s in North America, there was a panic around trafficking in women, which is very much the same as what's going on, which was used as a way for their own protection to block the immigration of Asian women who were perceived to be sex workers. Well, at that point, to be Asian, to be unmarried, to be non-Christian was essentially enough to be considered a whore by the white border guards. And so subsequently, in the next 10 years, the levels of Chinese women who immigrated to the United States dropped by 70%. Now, the laws against sex work are used by and large not only to, for many of the same reasons and with many of the same rationales as the ones before, they're also used to absolutely jam the prison system with poor women, most of whom are women of color or indigenous women. It's not just that the criminalization of the sex trade is in itself a form of violence, that it fosters violence. It's also that there's an incredible neglect. There's no resources for people in situations of violence when you're below the law, whether it's because you're a sex worker, whether it's because you're living on the street, whether it's because you're Native, whether it's because you're undocumented and therefore illegal, whether it's because you're a minor and a runaway, which makes it not only difficult to press charges, but it makes it, because, and this has happened before, another member of the coalition, that she was on a hospital bed when about to press charges for an assault when the police came in to investigate her for unpaid tickets related to sex work. On the hospital bed in the emergency room, which means that getting the basic services you need to protect your health and safety is all but impossible. Luckily, it's all but impossible. It is not impossible, and people have been fighting extremely hard to make it possible. But that violence, we have chosen to create it. That violence, we can choose that we will not have it anymore, that we will eliminate it, because we will eliminate criminalization. We will eliminate the attitudes and the hatred. We will take this violence seriously. I think another thing you have to keep in your heads is that you can't separate the violence and the idea that sex workers or people on the street are disposable from the fact that routinely we talk about how the cops are going to do a street sweep, they're going to clean up an area. They're completely interlinked. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that when you're talking about violence is that it's not just the most extreme cases of violence. It's the ability to work safely and securely, to work with other women, to protect your rights, to form labor organizations. All of these are completely compromised by the legal situation. So sex workers not only end up in a situation where you're running away from the law, but you're running away from other sex workers. You're isolated. You're not able to protect yourself because you're running away from the cops at all times. But arresting clients has the same effect. It pushes the whole industry underground. People hide, people are isolated, people can't work in safety, people can't protect themselves. And so during the period where the Montreal police started to crack down on clients, violence escalated immensely. And yet still, despite this, despite the fact that sex workers have been saying, no, this is a fundamental disrespect not only of my work, but also of my safety and my basic human rights, still, in the guise of protecting and saving sex workers, people who perhaps are well-meaning, I'm more and more thinking are conniving and evil, have been pushing these policies forward. And we're seeing it again. We're seeing it in not only in segments of the feminist movement, but in other social justice movements, where violence against sex workers, instead of being attacked for what it is, and the concrete ways to stop it, is used to condemn sex work as a whole and indirectly sex workers as a whole. And instead of criticizing the way that they're playing into the criminalization, as it's been brought up before, of poverty, of migration, of women who are autonomous as well, which is a big part of it.
That was part of a speech made by Ana Luiz Crego from the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers at a panel March 17th on the issue of police brutality. Anna Louise, like many sex workers and sex worker rights advocates, implicates the laws that currently criminalize sex work for much of the violence and danger sex workers face within the industry. The laws surrounding the sex trade in Canada are at their best ambiguous and at worst operate to criminalize the industry and make it dangerous for those working within it. In February, a motion made by federal NDP Member of Parliament Libby Davies to have a parliamentary committee review current sex trade laws was passed in the House of Commons. While the motion was not presented as an explicit step toward decriminalization, the task of the parliamentary committee will be to review the federal laws around sex work and recommend changes that would reduce the dangers facing sex workers. Many see this motion as implying the potential decriminalization of the industry. Legal reform designed by politicians and parliamentary officers both encourages and worries some sex worker rights advocates, given the myriad of ways the industry has been misunderstood. I spoke at length about the complexity of legal reform, specifically decriminalization of the industry, with Jen Clayman, a member of the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers here in Montreal and a member of the International Union of Sex Workers in London, England.
Sex work is not illegal. It does not say anywhere in sections 212 to 213 that sex work is illegal. Every activity surrounding it, however, is illegal, i.e., communicating for the purposes of selling sex, living off the earnings of sex. That could include your children. Your children could be implicated for that if you're supporting your children through the money you've earned. Your boyfriend could be implicated through that. It's the application of the law, really, and, mm-hmm. and they'll apply other laws. And what I found is they apply other laws in a backhanded way of making a moral judgment on sex work. It's a backhanded way of attacking sex work because the sex work laws are ambiguous and you can't really enforce them. Mm-hmm. You can, but you can't. It's hard to believe that it's about anything other than a moral judgment on the sex work itself. Mm-hmm. Because everything that they're doing and every initiative they take is focused around getting rid of sex work and not trying to maintain it or to allow people to do it or give them the space to do it, but make the conditions safer. It's right. Like, we're only going to help if we can help to get rid of it. Yeah. And although those will never be their words, that's sort of what it seems like.
The law against living off the avails of sex work is aimed not at sex workers themselves, but their affiliates. I asked Jen to explain the effect this law has on the capacity of sex workers to conduct their work safely.
What that law was created for, essentially, was pimps. What legal a law definers, I guess, would call a pimp. Pimp is a really funny way of calling a lot of people's boyfriends, a lot of people's parents or bosses or friends. You know, if women who work together for protection, like it's. But generally, what happens is that law gets applied in different ways. It gets applied to people who live with their boyfriends, who can't gain the protection of their neighbors because they can't tell their neighbors they're working because their neighbors won't like that they're working, so they don't have protection, and so they have their boyfriend there. But if they get caught working, their boyfriend gets charged with living off the earnings. You get charged with owning a brothel. You also don't have the protection of the police if anything goes wrong because you can't tell anybody you're there working. I don't understand how when you say you are not allowed to solicit, you're not allowed to communicate on the street and have the awareness that sex work is not going anywhere, where are those women going to go? Where do you think they're going to go? They're obviously going to go. They're going to stay on the street, but they're going to go out of view of the police. So out of view of police protection, but really also out of view of police harassment, and the two are interlinked here, and they're going to go to somewhere that they don't know, that isn't safe for them, where they're at risk of more violence, if that violence is going to exist, or where they're at risk of violence because people know they have lack of police protection. And I don't see how that is not considered in that law. Maybe the reason it wasn't considered is because the fact that sex work would still exist wasn't considered. The fact that people actually did choose to sex work, but although I'm not going to hone in the choice, but the fact that people actually are sex working. I mean, if you think about what criminalization is, what is it? It's the giving criminal status to people for whatever reason, and current laws around sex work. So sex work is not illegal, as we were talking about. But if you have a boyfriend who lives with you, he could be considered a pimp. The law has essentially criminalized your relationship, your affiliates, mm-hmm. by having a procuring loss that, mm-hmm. that doesn't allow you to have someone in the house while you're working, mm-hmm. or have a partner who you support. John is criminalized because he's asking someone for sexual service. He's made a criminal. And it makes it more dangerous, because when you are in threat of becoming a criminal, you hide. You don't let people know that you're there, because if you tell your neighbors, you could be known as a criminal. So it's you hide from the law, and when you hide from the law, you don't have access to the law. And other people know that you're hiding from the law, so they can take advantage of that, which is what's done, and they can abuse the situation by, you know, through violence, robbery, you know, anything really. So it's that that we need to stop from happening. So we need to remove laws that govern sex work.
While the stigma and the hateful stereotypes currently associated with sex work also act to undermine the efforts of sex workers to work safely, the criminalization of the trade is for many the central obstacle to the attainment of their human rights. Legal reform, therefore, is a major focus of most sex worker rights organizing.
Legal reform is what? Is at the crux of the sex workers movement, working towards decriminalization of the industry. What we call decriminalization is different than what a lot of other MPs call decriminalization. But, I mean, in essence, that's basically what the debate's about is law reform.
Okay.
I mean, within that, there's issues of violence, occupational rights, etc. And I think most of it will be touched on through law reform.
So maybe you can explain the difference, because I don't think a lot of people know, between decriminalization and legalization.
Okay. Decriminalization would mean a total removal of sex laws that currently exist. And that would be based on the premise that the sex laws that currently exist are ambiguous and do not enforce what they are intended to enforce, but in fact make it more dangerous for sex workers to work. Legalization of the industry would be an implementation of regulation on sex work, like mandatory STI testing is a very popular one. What that would do, and when that is applied, usually requires that sex workers are tested for STIs. It doesn't require that johns are tested for STIs, and sex workers are only as safe as their next client. And sex workers are, as we know anyways, more safe than their clients. It's the clients themselves that are requesting services that a condom. Like, in that, it makes the assumption that sex workers are vessels for STDs and that they kind of walk around and spontaneously breed HIV, without considering the rest of the population that have unsafe sex, that all the couples that have unsafe sex, all the people in this world that have unsafe sex, how many times have your friends had, have you, you know what I mean? It's ridiculous. If you legalize an industry, those kind of laws can be applied, and people and lawmakers can determine what they want the industry to look like. And it's not sex workers making those, shaping that. So it's really quite dangerous, actually. It's where things like John schools come in. It is when you get caught for communicating, you go to John school and you get taught how not to communicate with a prostitute again, because you're very bad for doing that, and you're preying on women. It's like a rehabilitation program for men who buy sex from women. It's a really funny, fucked up program. I mean, that happens anyways without legalizing the industry. But you can imagine if you said to somebody in Parliament, let's legalize sex work, where they would go with that. Like, what kind of laws would they make? You know, decriminalization is a word that we all use, and unfortunately we all have different definitions of what it is. What people get really excited, Libby Davies wants to decriminalize the industry. People get really excited. Oh, yes, Libby Davies is wonderful. She's fantastic. What does she mean? Mm-hmm. Feminists, abolitionists call for the decriminalization of the industry all the time. What are they saying? They're saying that all women are exploited. They're looking at women who are working, saying, you have not chosen to work. You are exploited. They're on a crusade to save women, but they're totally implementing a patriarchal structure of how they're going to do it, and it's ridiculous and absolutely ironic, and they don't realize that. And they will still say they want the industry decriminalized because the industry has violence, but they will say it inherently has violence. Whereas most activists won't.
There's much diversity and disagreement even among those who advocate decriminalization about, first of all, what it would look like and how it would be organized, and secondly, what ideas are premising such legal change and what the goals motivating it are.
I think what a lot of people think of decriminalization is they think of it as a step to helping people exit sex work. And I would argue that that's not what most sex worker rights movements are trying to postulate. What we say is that decriminalization, i.e. the removal of all laws on sex work, would bring about a safer working conditions, because it would be the removal of like the application of certain laws, or like the necessary application of certain laws.
The Canadian media has given a great deal of attention to the serial murder trial of Robert Picton in BC for the murders of at least 15 of 63 women who have gone missing. As many of these women have been linked to the sex trade, it is possible to see this horrific case of violence as being a major driving force behind Libby Davies' motion and current attention to possible decriminalization. I asked Jen what her concerns are in regards to the current focus on violence within the sex industry.
Well, I think there's danger in fighting for law reform based on one event, because this is a violent event. This is a hateful event. But it does not encompass all of the issues that are needed for law reform. Mm-hmm. So you're missing out on a lot of the labor issues, I think. You're missing out on a lot of the standards for a service industry. You're missing out on everything that doesn't have to do with violence, really. Because their thrust for law reform is coming out of a need to get rid of the violence, mm-hmm. instead of a need to accept the industry. And that's something very different. Like, I mean, we are also saying, obviously, that the violence has to stop. But we're implicating the law as the cause for that violence. Violence is not the only issue of protection in the sex trade. You know, there's occupational health and safety standards that need to be met. You know, issues of equal working conditions aren't considered here. It's issues of violence that are considered issues of protection, exploitation, safety in that context. The reason that I don't hone in on the violence is because I don't think it is exclusive to sex work. I think we need to look at other places that violence is happening against women, and more violence, like conjugal violence. How many date rapes do you know that have occurred? How many women do you know that are in relationships with total assholes? You know, these are the issues we need to be addressing as well. Self-esteem of women we need to be addressing, but that's what I think the sex worker rights movement does. You know, it addresses your self-esteem. It gives you the power to take control of your space in whatever circumstance you're working.
In a lot of these, this motion in particular, and in some of the debates surrounding the Libby Davies motion, there is sort of talk that alludes to the view commonly held by many who think of themselves as quite progressive, of the sex workers as being inherently exploited and as victims. So I've heard a lot of voices say, you know, that that's not the case. And it's really important to assert that there's nothing inherently exploitive about the work. So when is it exploitive, and how can a decriminalization policy address exploitation that does occur that isn't linked to anything essential about the work itself?
What needs to be asked is, why is exploitation inherent to the work itself? And that question hasn't been answered. I think when people answer that question, they talk about child prostitution, which I would say is not... Exploitation there is not limited to child prostitution. It's limited to child... It's about child abuse. Or they talk about trafficking. But migrant issues, immigration issues, are not limited to sex work. It's about immigration and migrant labor. So I don't think decriminalization of the sex industry is going to address those bigger issues, mm-hmm. unless they detach those issues of migration, of immigration, and of child abuse to the broader society views about those things. The more you blame sex work for these things, the less you're addressing it, and the further away from the problem you're getting. Are sex workers exploited? Yes. Are they exploited more than anyone else? No. It's about exploitation of labor. It's not sex work in itself. The exploitation that people are normally referring to is the degradation of women's bodies. You know, and that is not limited to sex work either. She didn't put forward a motion to decriminalize the industry. She put forward a motion, to have people review the laws. What she felt was decriminalization was never really spelt out. What she felt about the industry was never really spelt out either. We need to reduce the risk of exploitation. That is said a lot. We need to reduce the risk of children and residents. We need to help drug abusers. One of the MPs talks about improving the safety of communities. One of them talks about the unfortunate underfunding of the John School in Prince George. He calls the Johns prey. Those identify those who prey, the so-called Johns, on the sex workers themselves. And I just don't think that sex workers would see their clients as people who prey on them. Jay Hill was saying he was really concerned about the community and people who came into contact with prostitutes. Mm-hmm. So obviously, again, you've got the community first. And when he says community, he explicitly does not include sex workers mm-hmm. into that community, which alienates sex mm-hmm. workers again. Mm-hmm. It makes sex workers responsible for their alienation. Mm-hmm. So it makes it look like they've chosen to alienate themselves from society and the law, which they haven't. Mm-hmm. It's just that the laws are created to do that because they don't include sex workers. Mm-hmm. And so then if they come up with this new decriminalization law that protects the community, it's just going to look like the law that already exists. And that's like the communication law, which protects the community. Who do you have in mind when you're talking about creating these new laws?
A great many people spoke in favor of the motion, including members of the Liberal, the NDP, the Bloc Québécois, and the Alliance parties. I asked Jen for her analysis of the discourse that had ensued during the debate.
I don't know who the people are, where they're coming from, how focused on child prostitution are they? How are they going to differentiate between migrant workers and trafficked workers? How are they going to differentiate between child workers and adult workers? Who are advising these people is sort of what I'm interested in knowing. I'm curious to see how many sex workers are actually involved in that process. I mean, I think it's a good step. I don't want you to get me wrong. Obviously, my job is to pick this apart, to mm-hmm. see if this makes sense. I'm not going to come out and say, you know, I think they've got the wrong idea completely, because I don't think they do. I think what they need to do is consult people who understand the industry. And I think that is always a mistake, is that there's not enough consultation.
One of the arguments commonly made is that why should sex work not have any laws, given that every other service industry does? I asked Jen if she sees decriminalization encompassing any forms of regulation.
I think what people do is they advocate for the removal of the laws that exist and the replacement, eventually, of laws that make sense to the way the actual industry is shaped. But I think at the end of the day, you're going to have some sort of regulation. There might be a taxation system, and a lot of people say, oh yeah, why would you should unionize, you should be paying taxes, not realizing, obviously, that some sex workers pay taxes. But everyone will always say to me, well, why don't sex workers pay taxes like everybody else? And I'll say, well, you know what? You know, taxes are a responsibility of every citizen, but they definitely go hand in hand with rights. And if you're not given rights, then fuck the responsibilities. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't pay taxes if I was going to be paying for social workers to be on my asses and police to fucking harass me. No way. Until sex workers are considered to be able to shape that regulatory system, then it shouldn't be created. But it will be created, I hope. And I hope that sex workers create that, and that way it would be safer, and that way it'll make sense to the industry. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Long Term Memory Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Heating Up Radio, part 2 of a 4-week documentary exploration of the sex trade and its advocacy. We have been talking to Jen Clayman of the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers and the International Union of Sex Workers about legal change and the decriminalization of the sex trade in Canada. Stay tuned, because we will also be talking to Libby Davies, NDP, Member of Federal Parliament, about her recently passed motion to review the laws that currently apply to the sex industry in Canada. I guess it was back in November that you tabled your motion to the House of Commons for a special committee to be appointed to review current sex work. Can you just explain a little bit about what led you to table this motion and what you're hoping to achieve through it?
Well, I tabled the motion because it's a huge issue in the riding that I represent, which is East Vancouver. East Vancouver includes the downtown east side, which unfortunately is all too often in the news, not only in terms of sort of a drug crisis where people are dying from drug overdoses, but it's also very closely related to the sex trade, and it's the neighborhood where 61 women have gone missing. They were all involved in the sex trade, many of them Aboriginal. There's now, a huge murder trial going on, the largest serial murder trial in Canadian history. But the reason I brought forward this motion is that while all the attention has been on this trial, I wanted to really draw public attention and awareness to the fact that the desperate situation of these women, not only is it because there are like evil people out there who prey on these women, but also the whole sort of social economic environment that's created through like you know, provincial cutbacks. I mean, there's more and more women who are being forced onto the street into what we call the survival sex trade. You know, the whole issue around Canada's drug laws and the criminalization of drug users. And the more and more I got into the issue, and I've actually, you know, dealt with this issue for many years, even when I was a member of Vancouver City Council, I was always very concerned about the criminal code itself and the fact that the provisions in the criminal code that pertain to communicating around solicitation for prostitution actually, you know, further marginalize these women, because we have a whole law enforcement regime that really discriminates against women, that sort of reinforces the whole sort of environment that they are pieces of garbage that can just be disposed of, ignored, you know, that they can be harassed by police, they can be tried, convicted. And so I really wanted to draw attention to some of the more sort of systemic issues around discrimination and violence that pertain to the criminal code itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I brought the motion forward, because in actual fact, there hasn't been a review of the criminal code in this area since the Fraser Commission in 1985. And in fact, what we have seen over the years is that because there's been a lot of kind of visibility of on-street prostitution, if anything, there's been a move by police chiefs, by some community groups and so on, to have even stronger criminal sanctions,
right,
against prostitutes. And so my concern has always been that they, you know, they continue to be very marginalized and very criminalized, and that we're failing to address you know, the real dangerous situation that they are in, and the fact that we need to be dealing with that.
Right. You mentioned the phrase survival sex trade. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, it may vary from province to province, but there are more and more women who are being forced into the sex trade because they are living in like total poverty. I mean, some of these women have children. Many of them are you know, living in a very sort of subsistence way. I mean, here in BC, we've had like massive cutbacks in social services and income support in housing, and as a result, I mean, it's almost impossible to, you know, to get through the month without resorting to you know, to other kinds of activities for income. The other issue that's very closely related is drug use, and many of these women are facing very serious addiction problems. And again, what, you know, instead of there being, you know, proper help and support and treatment and ways to, you know, deal with the addiction, what we typically see is that, you know, again, women become very sort of marginalized because basically they're forced into a criminal lifestyle. So often, if they're a user, they end up involved in the sex trade as a way of supporting their addiction, because, you know, they're forced into a criminal lifestyle because these drugs, because the substances that they're using, whether it's heroin or cocaine, are illegal. So it, you know, becomes a very, very dangerous situation. I mean, not only in terms of overdoses from drug use by, you know, taking, often people don't know what they're taking because it's bought on the black market, or you know, health conditions are completely unsanitary. So that, I mean, that would be one element of risk. But then when women are also involved in the sex trade, they're at greater risk of violence and even death by being involved in those activities. Again, because it's, you know, it's like we, as a society, we turn a blind eye to this, right? We we say we don't want to tolerate the visibility of on-street prostitution, even though we turn a blind eye to off-street prostitution through escort services. So there's all kinds of contradictions.
Do you think that's because it's still considered morally, you know, offensive?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, because I think a lot of it has to do as a class issue, because, you know, when it, I mean, there's all kinds of other prostitution activities, right? There's other kinds of, there's other elements of the sex trade that are very well tolerated, like, for example, escort agencies or massage parlors, where municipalities even license these facilities, knowing full well that they're, you know, basically a front for prostitution. So, you know, we seem to be able to say, well, that's okay, right? Mm-hmm. So somehow the moral argument doesn't apply there. But it, when it comes to women who are basically on the street and who are obviously, you know, pretty near destitute, then it's a different story. And, all you know, they do become subject to various kinds of enforcement and complaint procedures and harassment and violence and, as I say, even death. And so, it, my motion was to really draw attention to that. And I don't know if you know, but the motion actually has been approved.
Right. And that was recently, wasn't it?
Yes. And I was actually very amazed at the amount of support that this motion has had from pretty well all sides of the House.
I actually wanted to ask you about that because I've been reading through the transcripts a little bit of the February debate, and I was a little bit surprised as well that members of Parliament from across the sort of party spectrum supported this. Do you think everyone's coming from the same page?
Not necessarily. No. I mean, I think the motion really hit a nerve. I did lobby very hard. I met with the Justice Minister, and you know, Mr. Cauchon, and said point blank, you know, like, as a Minister of Justice, you have to be aware that the criminal code itself is contributing to the high risks that these women are in, and you know, we should not, you know, this should not be allowed to happen. We need to have a review of these laws. I also talked to many other MPs, and I think one thing is that there are other MPs in other communities, like particularly urban areas, who are facing similar problems, and they don't quite know what to do about it. Now, not everybody is going to have the same ideas for how to resolve this.
Right.
I know that for a fact. And my motion deliberately was pretty general because I want to have, you know, I want the debate to be opened up.
Mm-hmm.
I want people involved in the sex trade to be heard. I want women who are, you know, who are dealing with this on a daily basis to be heard. I think it's very important that their point of view be heard in terms of what we can be doing to improve both their ability to exit the sex trade and provide, you know, real alternatives and support and help, but also, as long as they are involved, how do we ensure that they are not at such huge risk?
Mm-hmm. Has the special committee of the House, has it been appointed?
No, not yet. What happened was the motion was debated, and there was an agreement and a vote on basically sending the matter to the Justice Committee, and now it's up to the Justice Committee to do the review, and likely they will do it through a subcommittee, and there'll be, you know, all party representation on the subcommittee, and I'm hopeful that will begin in the next couple of months. And as I say, my objective is to ensure that there are hearings that can be held across the country so that we can actually have witnesses and testimony.
Okay.
Because I've had like amazing feedback from people right across the country, from academics, from organizations who work with people involved in the sex trade, from community groups. You know, I've had just an amazing amount of feedback from people who really want to be involved in some kind of debate and review of this matter.
So am I right to suppose that that this review may potentially act as a first step towards eventual decriminalization?
It could. I mean, I think that's a matter that's very much on the table. My motion, consciously does not spell out any sort of prescriptive resolution.
Right.
But I think, I mean, just from the feedback that I've had, I think a lot of people are thinking that is, you know, one possibility that should be looked at. I mean, the way I want to approach it is in a similar way that I've approached the drug issue in my riding, and that is from a point of view of how do we reduce the harm both to communities that are impacted by the sex trade and by people who are involved in the sex trade. And you know, we can get into all of the moral issues, and there are issues of exploitation that we have to deal with, right? I mean, how do we ensure that women are not being exploited and violated? How do we ensure that there is better safety? But I think if we approach it with the objective to reduce harm and exploitation and improve safety for communities and those who are involved in the sex trade, because they're often pitted against each other, you see. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the big problems. It's the same with the drug issue. You know, if you try to do anything to help, you know, drug users or prostitutes, you know, the argument goes, well, you're harming local communities. And often the prostitutes are scapegoated by local communities who are saying, you know, get these people out of here. We don't, you know,
right.
we don't want this in our backyard.
Right.
And there are legitimate concerns for local communities about
the sex, what are some right? of the community concerns? Because that is spoken to a lot in this
well,
motion.
I mean, I think most obviously any neighborhood that residential area or even local businesses where the sex trade is taking place, it can be incredibly disruptive. It can be incredibly harming to that community in terms of, you know, John's driving around, people being propositioned, you know, children being exposed to, you know, sort of ongoing soliciting and even, you know, sort of sexual activities. Condoms lying around. I mean, you know, there are community impacts. My goal, though, is to find a way to develop a dialogue and a debate that doesn't sort of, you know, pit one neighborhood or one group against women who are involved in the sex trade and sort of make these women scapegoats. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think mm-hmm. there has to be a way to recognize the, you know, legitimate community concerns around the sex trade, and also recognize, you know, the legitimate issues for those involved in the sex trade and the great risk that they're at. So I mean, it's a very complex issue.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I feel like if there's a genuine kind of willingness to have a debate, to be open, then maybe there are some both legal and social sort of resolutions that we can look at, and we can look at what's being done elsewhere and see what is working and what isn't, right? I mean, there's also, I've been in contact with quite a few academics, including actually at Concordia. I've received a whole slew of sort of academic work, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's been quite a lot of academic research that's taken place, and it, you know, it really needs to be part of the public debate as well.
I wanted to touch on the idea of exploitation and just maybe ask you to expand in regards to how exploitation happens within the sex industry, because I think there are a lot of people who see the industry itself as inherently exploitive, and a lot of people involved in the actual sex trade who would contest that idea. In your motion, you say that one of the tasks of the committee is to recommend changes that will reduce the exploitation and violence against sex workers. So maybe you can speak to what you think that means.
Well, I mean, it's a very difficult area because I know there are varying points of view, particularly within the women's community. I mean, we've got a group here in Vancouver, Vancouver Rape Relief, who actually they wrote a letter to the Vancouver Sun saying that my motion was going to increase exploitation of women, you know, and they characterized it as anything that sort of sanctions this activity, as they saw it, would be, increasing the victimization and exploitation of women, which is clearly not the intent. But there is, you know, there's very strong debates going on even in the feminist community about how one defines this issue. I guess in my own mind, I sort of try to look at it in terms of, there is this issue of the survival sex trade, where women are out of economic or, you know, sort of social conditions becoming engaged in this these kinds of activities. And I do think it's really important that we actually look at ways to reduce the harm that's taking place, right?
Right.
I mean, there have been studies in Vancouver that show, for example, that women involved in the sex trade who are heroin users are particularly at risk when they're in withdrawal from heroin, because they become very vulnerable to any kind of violence or exploitation sexually. And so, you know, I mean, I think there's various levels of how you can respond and try to provide help and support.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which is clearly to emphasize the need to provide a way for women to get out of the sex trade, right?
Do you think that? But, do you see that sort of as an ultimate goal? The
exiting? No, I don't think it's the only goal. I mean, I don't think you can force people out of whatever activity, whether they're drug users or involved in the sex trade or whatever. So I think the overall goal has to be to, improve the safety and the health status and the environment that person is in, and to ensure that there are options for other choices, right? I don't think it's about coercion, and it certainly shouldn't be about criminalizing women who are involved in these activities. So I think in terms of the survival sex trade, part of it is looking for ways to, you know, even on a very immediate daily or nightly basis, like, you know, what can be done? Like, should there be safe houses? Should we be allowing, you know, some sort of cooperatives to exist, such as was suggested by the Fraser Commission in 1985 that was never taken up? But at the same time, providing real resources so that women can be exiting the sex trade without being further penalized or marginalized. I think there's also other elements of the sex trade that don't get a lot of attention, where, you know, people would say this is a work issue, it's a choice issue. And so there's that element of it, too. I mean, I don't know how much we'll get into all of these questions, because it does get pretty complicated. But my immediate concern is what's happening to the women on the street right now. But they are incredibly vulnerable. They're in a very dangerous situation. I mean, how can we prevent more women from going missing or being in a kind of situation where they are really subject to, you know, the most terrible forms of violence and abuse?
I also just quickly wanted to ask you about the laws that currently exist in the criminal code regarding the clients of sex work. Do you see room in this arena for legislative review as well? And if so, how?
Well, that's not. I mean, I haven't researched that side as much myself. Right. Then, you know, again, once this committee is established, I mean, it won't only be me. It will be, you know, representatives of all parties. And my guess is that, you know, the whole question will sort of be put on the table in terms of, you know, sex trade workers as well as johns. What do we do in terms of pimps?
Because I know a lot of the current criminalizing laws have to do with the johns.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you're in Montreal, but in Vancouver we have, you know, something called a john school where people get sent. But again, you see, there's so many contradictions in the law, because you can go to an escort service, right, and you're not penalized. So all of the law enforcement is focused on street prostitution, and I feel that, you know, one thing we have to look at is the contradictions in the law, in our in our own view as a society of how we view this issue, and to say, well, I mean, and again, I'm not saying that I know what the answer is, but I feel that, you know, there are different standards at work here, and you know, it is partly based on a class issue, right, in terms of how we tolerate this.
So what happens now?
Well, Parliament reconvenes on Monday, and I have been, you know, in constant contact with the chair of the Justice Committee, you know, sort of to find out when this subcommittee will be set up. And I'll be continuing to do that, because I'm certainly not going to let it go. And as I say, there's there's been an incredible amount of interest. So the Justice Committee has got a lot on its plate right now, but I'm hopeful that the subcommittee could be set up in, you know, sort of the immediate future. And then the committee will have to sort of develop a work plan and decide how it wants to conduct this review. So I'm not going to prejudge that. I mean, I have to work with my colleagues from all sides to kind of get that to happen. But as I say, I've got some ideas, and I'll certainly, you know, be adding my two cents worth on the subcommittee, or however it transpires.
Well, thank you so much
for
talking with me today. You have just been listening to an interview with Libby Davies, NDP Member of Federal Parliament from Vancouver East. My name is Brett Story, and this is Heating Up Radio, a 4-week documentary exploration of the sex trade and its advocacy. This is week 2, and we have been talking about legal reform and the decriminalization of the sex trade.
We must work together to change the things that's wrong. For better conditions, we're waiting much too long. Health and safety have to be a first priority. And the change can only come through you and me. Yes, the change can only come through you and me.
No
Notions of decriminalization that are driven from the view that sees sex work as violence cause great concern to many sex worker rights advocates. I spoke to Jen Clayman about her belief that unionizing might be not just a tool for asserting labor rights, but also a way of setting up a context for decriminalization in which sex work is considered legitimate work. I talked to Jen about the tactic of unionizing sex workers and her work with the International Union in London.
Okay, I'm Jen Clayman. I work with the International Union of Sex Workers and have for 3 years. I'm currently in Canada trying to see what I'm interested now in just sort of surveying mentally anyways what the options for unionizing are here. If people want to unionize here, mm-hmm. People don't necessarily want to do that, and I can't come in here and be like, we should unionize, because it might not be the right context.
What is the International Union?
Of sex workers? It's a collective, thank you. It's a collective of sex workers and allies, essentially working towards decriminalization and safer working conditions. Most of the context under which we work is labor rights. So one of our initial goals was to join a trade union. That happened a lot faster than we thought. We'd approached about 3 or 4, maybe more, trade unions, and they'd all laughed in our faces. But the GMB, which is the third biggest union in London, did take us on. They've got about 8,000 members in total, so which is a huge support, and you know, for people to be behind us on that.
So members in all sorts of other economic fields,
Other trades like tailors. GMB stands for General Municipal Boilermakers, and that's where it originated from. So with the clout of this union, we can do a lot of political campaigns. We have. I mean, we do campaigns as the IUSW, and then we either make a decision to bring in the GMB or not. Mm-hmm. Under some circumstances, it's good too, and under some, it's not, because we do need freedom sometimes to be able to politicize our views highly. Most people don't understand how you can unionize a trade that is illegal.
Right.
But it's not an illegal trade, and that's what's really important to remember. So as long as it's not illegal, you're okay to do it. It's like saying, if you're an illegal immigrant here, you don't have any rights. But there are tons of refugee... if you're a refugee here, you don't have any rights, pardon me. But there are tons of refugee councils and refugee rights groups, for people who do have rights. And why are they... Exploring less why people have chosen to flee to Canada. More to say, she has rights in our country as well. And I would say that's sort of akin to the sex worker rights movement in a way, obviously not a lot of ways, but in one way being, we have to question the context of the law and why the law exists and whether or not that law goes against our own human rights, which I would say in the case of sex work law, it does.
I asked Jen whether or not she would like the London Union to become international in scope, given that the sex trade is in many ways an international labor issue.
It was called an international union because it embraces the international aspect of the workers in London. I don't want to sort of turn the IUSW into a corporate identity by having branches, I would like to see that happen, because it would unite all of the countries together, and in that we are strength in numbers. The problem in that is that everybody's working under different context, which is fine because you can adapt. I mean, here is a model for sex work unions that we have created. Mm-hmm. You take it, adapt it, do what you want with it. But obviously at the heart of it be, dedicated to labor issues. Mm-hmm. So now I'm discussing these issues with the coalition who I'm now working with. Are you interested in unionizing? Why or why not? What are the issues around that? Let's chat with people in the community. Let's chat with people who've unionized before, which we're going to be doing. So it's happening, but
right.
It's just happening. It's happening slowly.
Yeah.
And mobilizing is hard anywhere, anyways. Like it's really hard to mobilize people who are actually working, because most people who are working are not interested in being part of a movement,
mm-hmm.
and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a big issue, and there's obviously a lack of resources.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the the arguments against unionization? What's the debate about?
From sex workers?
From sex workers.
A lot of sex workers misinterpret unionizing as working to legalize the industry, which we are not doing in any way. We advocate for decriminalization. We are not against some sort of policy. There will be policy implications within that, meaning there will be need to be some sort of regulation. But we advocate for that regulation to be shaped by sex workers themselves and not by policymakers. The union essentially was created to address some of these issues on a political level, but also to give people some practical support. So if you, you know, if you belong to a union, if you're dancing in a club, for example, and in London it's different than it is here, but in London anyways, if you're working in a club and your owner or your boss does, like they did in the Lusty Ladies Club, does start, you know, scheduling you according to race, is discriminatory to you, you can bring your union on this. You don't receive benefits, you don't receive sick pay. And in what the Lusty Ladies Union did in California was, these are some of the things that they were fighting for. It was for contracts, sick pay, like regular shifts and shifts that weren't according to their race or age, etc. And they received a lot of what they fought for.
I asked if the London Union utilizes tactics common to unions in other industries, such as the tactic of striking.
The IUSW in London, we did a strike once. We had a strike in Soho. And some people worked, some people didn't. It was more just a strike just because Westminster Council was trying to sweep out the area, clean up the area, try to get all the sex workers to leave. And they're still doing it, actually. And we were there, you know, with our sort of sex worker pride banners and international, you know, sex worker banners, dancing in the streets with our samba band. And it was a celebration of sex worker rights, but it was also a strike against the city. Yeah, so that was a type of strike. We don't really strike, per se, as the Lusty Ladies Union strikes, because we don't all come from the same workplace. So a strike as such wouldn't make sense. I mean, these are great things about the union. There's obviously downfalls, and that's, yeah, it doesn't offer protection against violence. Although we do campaign against it, it doesn't offer the protection against it because the laws are ambiguous and we haven't changed the laws. So we have to work within the context of the laws that already exist. We can contest them, but, I mean, that's after the fact if something happens, yeah, like a violent attack, like police brutality, etc. A lot of sex workers say, no, we prefer working underground. I'm comfortable. I know my workspace right now. I know how to maneuver. I know what to look out for. I know how to lead my double life, and I'm very comfortable doing that. And I respect that, and it makes sense. Because they've had to. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a safety thing. Like, you, mm-hmm, learn how to work in your own environment, and to take that away is really scary. And I don't. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is a really difficult point to work with, because, mm-hmm, it's working towards not a normalization, but a
legitimization.
Yeah, I would say legitimizing the industry, basically. And not everybody wants it to be legitimized, and that is a point of contention, and that's something that I haven't yet figured out how to work around.
Yeah, why do you think not everyone wants it legitimized?
I think they're scared. Like, do we really think the stigma is going to go away? Do we really think that if you take away the laws, all sex workers are going to be accepted?
Right.
People aren't going to think they're dirty whores. Like, you can't expect that to go away overnight, and that's a lot of hard work.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity.
Solidarity.
You have been listening to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy, episode 2 of a 4-week series. I would like to thank Jen Clayman, Libby Davies, and Anna Louise Crago. Thanks also to the news coordinator here at CKUT, Gretchen King. Next week, we explore the gendered implications of sex work and talk about some of the ways gender issues inform the work. If you would like a copy of tonight's episode or the series as a whole, call CKUT's news department here in Montreal at 514-398-6787, extension 2593. My name is Brett Story for CKUT 90.3 FM, long-term memory radio. Thanks for listening.
In our hands is placed a power greater than the hearted gold, greater than the might of armies, magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to world a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.